Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Steve Galletta, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the Bighorn River. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve Galletta about fly fishing the Bighorn River. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. They're located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Before we introduce Steve, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Steve's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Steve's latest book, Fly Fishing the Bighorn River, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So here's how you can win Steve's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something Steve and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage, the same place that you'll be able to answer or ask questions during the show. So listen closely and use your best typing skills and be fast about it. Sometimes it's just a matter of a couple of seconds that determines the winner. And you might be the lucky person to win that book, Fly Fishing the Bighorn River. Our guest tonight is Steve Galletta. Steve is the co-owner, outfitter of Bighorn Angler in Fort Smith, Montana, and the author of Fly Fishing the Bighorn River, released in July of 2015 by Stackpole and Headwater Books. His passion for the hatch dry fly fishing brought him to the Bighorn River 10 years ago, where he was introduced to anglers to the intricacies, the one of the world's best tailwater rivers. During the off-season, he enjoys sharing his fly fishing passion with others by doing slideshow presentations for the fly fishing show, attendees, and trout clubs. He believes that we all have a responsibility to give back to the rivers that provide us with so much enjoyment. In an effort to sustain the blue ribbon trout fishery that is the Bighorn River, he is actively involved with the Bighorn River Alliance, Bighorn River Foundation. For more of his content, you can find him on bighornangler.com. That's bighornangler.com. Well, Steve, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. I really appreciate you having me here. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is fun. It's always fun to talk about the Bighorn, and like we were talking before the show, that was the first Montana river that I ever fished. So and was with my father, who's no longer with us. So, some really good memories from back then. So always fun to talk about the Bighorn. Well, we've got lots of things to cover. And let me just ask you what, you've been there for what, about 10 years or so now or more?
Yeah, I've been here 10 years actually, you know, working and outfitting the river.
Yeah. How far back do you go to when your first experience on the Bighorn was?
Probably was about 2001. I came out here with a youth organization as a host on a trip with a bunch of kids, and then that's where I fell in love with this river. So, you know, I've been showing people this river for a long time.
Yes. So what makes it so special to you?
Yeah, to me, it's the most consistent wild trout fishery in the world. And consistent, I mean, you can really come here 365 days a year and have a successful angling day. And the other key to that is that it's a wild trout fishery. These are self-sustaining populations of trout. There's no stocking whatsoever in the Bighorn anymore. After the dam was created and the river was open to angling in 1981, there was original stockings in this river. But those fish began naturally reproducing very quickly. And since then, it's been self-sustaining populations that haven't had to be supplemented by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So I think that's a key ingredient is they're wild trout. So they're very savvy trout, and they give anglers great challenge. So, and there's great hatches on this river. And it's also, you know, the key to this river to me is that it's the most, one of the most user-friendly rivers in the entire West. Anglers of all ages and abilities can come here, have a good time, catch trout. It's very easy to wade, easy to float, easy to learn how to row. So there's a lot of angling opportunity for people of all ages and experiences.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, yeah, and the variety of fishing there is really, really pretty incredible. It's about, you know, anything you want, you can probably find in that that stretch of water, you know, as a fly fisherman. So I always enjoyed that variety.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have, you know, people don't take advantage of the entire Bighorn River fishery that we have here. There's 35 miles of solid, you know, blue ribbon trout fishery here. Everybody, you know, comes to fish the upper river, which is the upper 13 miles of the Bighorn River. And that's the famous stretch with the, you know, really high populations of trout, you know, back in the day in the early 90s and in late 80s, as high as 10 to 12,000 fish per mile. You know, I'd say right now we have about, you know, 6,000 catchable fish per mile above 9 inches, brown and rainbow trout. Right now, we probably have a good mix of about 70 to 75% brown trout versus rainbow trout, and there's several factors that go into that, mostly water levels during spawning. But a lot of people don't come here and utilize that lower river enough, and, you know, the lower river at times can fish completely different and offer completely different opportunity than the upper river does.
Right.
It's not as quite user-friendly as that upper river is, but the anglers that take the time to learn it really enjoy it and, you know, tend to go back there year after year. And I think the main reason people don't go down there is, you know, relative comparison to the upper river, there's far fewer fish per mile. I mean, say somewhere around 1,500 to 3,000 fish per mile anywhere below Bighorn. And, you know, compared to the upper river, there's not many fish, but compared to other famous waters in Montana, you know, that's about average for other healthier freestone fisheries. So definitely great opportunity top to bottom.
Yeah, we did get a question from Rick. He's in Montana. He said, slash California, back and forth, I guess. He says, Steve, after fishing the Bighorn at least once a year over the past 11 years, I have concluded that its brown trout population has increased, its rainbow population has declined, and the average size has decreased. Do you agree, and can you please explain?
Yeah, I mean, fish populations on the Bighorn are always going to be cyclic with flows and, you know, the year classes. But a lot of it has to do with the flows when the fish are spawning. And we've had really erratic flows over the past, since about 2011, as far as we've had a lot of high water years. You know, typical flow on this river that I want to, you know, personally see is about 3,500 CFS. And we've had water events all the way up to 14,000 CFS, and that's based on all how the water is managed each year. But when you get really low conditions in the spring and then really high conditions, you know, at the same time when those fish are trying to spawn, a lot of times you don't get successful spawns. We've had much more consistent water flows in the fall when the brown trout have been spawning versus when in the spring. When those rainbows are. So you get the year classes have been much more negatively impacted in the spring spawn, those rainbows. On high water years, typically the browns have a better success rate of spawning. So that's why we're seeing the the higher rate of brown trout for sure. They're more adept to surviving in this fishery, and they take hold. But I think we started seeing that correct itself a little bit this year. It'll be interesting, you know, to hear the most recent shocking numbers come out for the end of this year and next year. I think we're going to see a little bit of a shift into maybe that 65% brown trout. So we are, you know, as anglers, we're definitely catching a lot more, you know, nicer rainbow trout. And as far as the size goes, the past few years, the average size was definitely down. Not this year, but the 2 years previously, the size was down, but we actually caught a couple really big fish. We got, I don't know, there's three or four fish on the upper 13 miles of the river caught between 24 and 27 inches last year. And then this year, we saw definitely a lot more 16 to 18 inch trout with not as many true, you know, trophy trout over that 2 foot mark. But this year, I'd say the average trout, you know, among all of our guides was that many more fish in that 20 inch range, you know, were caught. There just, you know, wasn't that, those true trophies this year, nearly, and much more few and far between.
Yeah, I remember back when I first fished it, and that was probably 25 years ago. I remember catching back then more rainbows than browns. So it has shifted. That's interesting. Now, has the water temperature changed, or is it still pretty consistent coming out of the dam? I mean, because generally browns prefer a little warmer water, don't they, than the rainbows?
Yeah, the first thing to definitely realize on the bighorn is everything is dictated by water temperature. I mean, blueing olives, as far as I'm concerned, come off when it's 43 degrees. And the fish are, you know, definitely going to act differently. Their metabolism rates change based on water temperature. And this year was the warmest water temperatures I've ever seen on the bighorn. And even right now, you know, what are we in mid-November already? We're still running guide trips out yesterday. And this is the warmest water year I've ever seen on the Bighorn, where the water coming out of After Bay Dam was 60 degrees in August, which 2 years ago it was 46 degrees in August coming out of the dam.
Wow.
So you can see these huge temperature swings. And that, a lot of that's based on, to me, you know, we had one up to 14,000 CFS in that reservoir. Well, you got a lot more water being evacuated. A lot of that cold water, you know, from a bottom release dam is being released. Well, you know, it's not going to fill in. You know, when all that water gets evacuated, there's not as much cold water, you know, filling in on the back end. So I think on high water years, we typically get warmer water temperatures. The other factor is once the water goes up above 7,000 CFS, the water starts coming out of the top of the dam and some of those upper gates. So you have warmer water coming off the top of the reservoir and mixed with the colder water coming off the bottom. During low water years, you strictly get that water off the bottom, and you see colder water temperatures. And that's also why we get less weeds during those low water years, because when those water temps spike, you know, you get a lot more aquatic vegetation definitely starting to grow once you hit August. So a lot of factors there.
Yeah, a lot of factors because, you know, people come up to the rivers like that and they just expect it to be the same every year, you know. Well, last year it was fantastic. Shouldn't it be fantastic this year? But a lot of that, you know, is controlled by, like you say, so many factors that it's really hard to say. And the river will evolve and change, I suppose, over time.
Yeah, and it affects the timing of the hatches more than anything. And I've seen, you know, the trico hatch can be a 3 to 4 week swing every year depending on water temperature. I've seen tan caddis come off in October. I've seen trichos, you know, start coming off in July. I've also seen them start coming off in September. So especially same thing with black caddis, you know, it was more of a July event, you know, this year when typically it's August into early September event. So
right.
It's all dictated by water temperatures. And we had, you know, one of the warmest winters on record this year, and the year before we had one of the coldest. So you know, a lot of people, you know, don't realize, you know, it's a tailwater river, and they think, you know, hey, it's Disneyland, it's, you know,
right,
it's controlled, you know, controlled by the dam, but Mother Nature still has a lot of influence on this fishery and the timing of it. So, you know, the consistency of this fishery is that you're going to come here and catch fish. What you're going to do to catch those fish is always, you know, somewhat up for question. But, yeah, I mean, there's certain times that are consistent. You can expect to fish certain techniques, but good question.
Brian Adams in Bakersfield, California says, any comments on the big pike caught on the Bighorn? Have you ever seen one caught on the river?
Sure, yeah. I mean, typically that one made the news. I mean, in this day and age where everything makes news because of social media, I mean, we got more phone calls on that thing like it was the first time, like, you know, some alien fish, you know, swam up the bighorn. But, yeah, the lower bighorn has a lot of warm water species, walleye, catfish, goldeye, and pike. And every year the guides typically find a pike, you know, somewhere in the system. That one just happened to make, you know, big news, and it was a really big pike. There's also quite a few walleye in that first mile of the river as well that are trout eaters. But usually, typically, you know, and that happened to be caught by a non-guide where, you know, typically a guide will catch those fish and eradicate them from the system, you know, pretty quick, and it doesn't make news. So,
where was that caught?
That was caught at Crow Beach. So that was about 6 miles probably from the dam.
Oh, so, yeah, that's far up. Okay.
Yeah, that far up. But at the same time, during warm water years, I've seen goldeye move up, which is basically like a shad for those of you guys that don't know what it is. But you catch they're very eager fish. They, you know, they take flies really well. But I actually have seen them on one occasion all the way up at the Cars, which is about 5 miles, which is just up from Crow Beach. And I've seen them all the way up there in some warm water years. So wow. The fish definitely do move throughout this system. And yeah, it's something that I wish Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks would study more to see, especially the trout, do they move up from the lower river 20 miles down and come spawn in the upper 3 miles of the river? And that's, you know, the radio telemetry studies is one thing that I keep pushing for. I'd like to see how these trout move and, you know, fish, you know, move throughout the system during the year and, you know, see if you can somewhat time that movement as an angler. I think that would be really interesting to find out. They do a lot of that stuff in the Missouri. We just haven't seen it done on the bighorn yet. So.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Dan Leibarger from Abingdon, Illinois, he wrote in, he says, what's your favorite time of year to fish on the bighorn? And also, Ernie from Arizona, similar question, what's the best time to come up there? Maybe you can
talk about
both those things.
Yeah, there's kind of two answers to those questions is, you know, one of the most popular times and then one of the times that I enjoy. And, you know, the shoulder seasons are becoming increasingly popular. And for me, March and early April, I really love that time because I'm going to have consistent midge and blueing olive emergences occurring. And then also late, like October, and it's amazing how far people are extending this fishery. Like I said, we had a few guide trips out this week. But I definitely like that shoulder season. If you're looking, you know, if you're a really good angler and are pretty self-sufficient on the water, that shoulder season, and you're willing to kind of do it all, whether it's, you know, if the dry flies are not happening, you're willing to fish streamers or nymphs, that shoulder season can be really good. If you're looking at target specific techniques and strategies for the river, I mean, the most popular times on the bighorn are the end of April and early May because it's almost, you know, certain that you're going to hit the blueing olive hatch very well. And the blueing olive is the most consistent, you know, hatch during that springtime. And then the other, you know, really busy time for anglers, because the fishing is also good again, is end of July, early August. And at that time, you know, you can get a smorgasbord during that summer, main summer window. You can have your black caddis hatch, which is your kind of going to happen year in and year out on the bighorn. And then you can have trichos, and then, of course, your terrestrial fishing and possibly pale morning duns as well. So that's definitely the most popular. I mean, that end of August, for some reason, gets overlooked a little bit. I think a lot of people think the hatches are going to be tapering off, and they're not. That end of August for dry fly fishermen especially, and then early September, our water stays a lot warmer because that whole reservoir, the whole body of water needs to cool. So even right now, we're sitting here mid-November, and the water coming out of the dam is still in the mid-50s right now. So for those dry fly fishermen, you can come later in the year and still experience, you know, some really good dry fly fishing, at least well into September. Nymph fishermen, God, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to pick a bad time. Typically, I guess those that are trying to avoid the aquatic vegetation and the nuisance that could become from the nymph fishing, you know, I definitely would say come before August. But the nice thing is once the water starts warming up in August, the fish slide up into the riffles here, and the fish utilize this entire river. And the one thing I like to say, bighorn trout, they will choose food over shelter. It's basically a constant conveyor belt of food coming down this river. So, you know, they're in super skinny water. And I tell my clients all the time, don't walk on the fish, because you're the first person through a run, those fish will be slid up where it's easiest and most efficient to consume calories. And you can sight nymph on this river, and that's what this makes the summer really special for nymph fishermen, is you can have tremendous sight nymphing opportunity. Kind of, you know, just like you'd have on the Spring Creeks in Paradise Valley, but you can do it here on a large western tailwater river. So it's a pretty loaded question, but just kind of depends. You know, February is one of my favorite months to go strip streamers on the lower river. You can fish big articulated white streamers and get some really nice brown and rainbow trout down there. And then again, you know, our fish spawn, our brown trout spawn a lot later. So while our brown trout will spawn in, you know, a typical Yellowstone or big hole fish will spawn in October, our fish won't start spawning till end of November, mid-November, even into December, quite a lot. So our good fall streamer window is actually a lot later into that October, second half of October into November. So, you know, there's definitely those tendencies, but, you know, expect definitely some variation and be prepared to do just about anything, no matter when you come here. But
not
really
you
a
know,
bad time.
Those shoulder areas, those shoulder months that you talk about, I remember being up there on a trip and, you know, and I think it was like late September and it started snowing and there was a cold spell that came in really quickly. So we went from a really nice day to a snowy day the next day, so you never know. But like this year has been really dry, you know, up until, even now it's still dry here in the Rockies, so like we were talking about. So kind of an unusual fall going on. But and it's always a great place to fish no matter what time of year, right? It's just that's the way it is. We need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Steve more about fly fishing the Bighorn River, and we'll start digging into a little tour downriver. So stick with us, folks, and we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and technique. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Gallette about fly fishing the Bighorn River. Steve, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in their fly fishing world. So tell us a little bit about your business and what's happening up there. I know you're involved in some sports conservation efforts as well. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I'm myself and my partner, we own the Bighorn Angler in Fort Smith here. We have lodging, drift boat rentals, guide service, and all-inclusive packages, lodging, meals, you know, and guide service. All in one, and that's kind of what we specialize in. But, yeah, I mean, we're here year-round, and we're open year-round, fishing the river, you know, every week. And I think one of the biggest things that I can ask, you know, others to do is the Bighorn River is one of the most heavily used rivers in the state of Montana. People love it, and we have a great fishery, but I think what people need to do is give back to this river. And the Bighorn River Alliance this year hired its first executive director. And she came over from the Henry's Fork and has been over there for about 11 years protecting that river, and we're lucky to have her. But we're definitely looking for people to contribute so we can, you know, help sustain this fishery for what it is. And there's, you know, a lot of politics that go into maintaining this fishery, being that the flows are controlled by the Bureau of Reclamation, National Park Service, the Crow Tribe all have an influence in that. So, you know, definitely support the Bighorn River Alliance so, you know, we can protect this fishery. And if everybody does their part, I think we can make it a better fishery. And the biggest thing that we can try to do is water flows and help maintain the flows and get stable flows that, you know, benefit the populations of trout in this river. And the other thing that's really important to me, too, is cleaning up a lot of these irrigation returns that come into this river and water quality testing so we can make that lower river even a much more productive fishery and a more consistent fishery like the upper river is throughout the year.
Okay, good. Why don't you give everybody your website address again, just in case they missed it?
Yeah, it's just bighornangler.com, and you know, we have all of our package information on there, and I guess the biggest thing we do is our blog where it has updated fishing reports very regularly, and we have some great YouTube videos on there for rigging and, you know, dry fly videos and a bunch of really good videos on there that are very good instructional tools.
Okay, good. Okay, let's jump back in here. I want to take a we did get a few questions here on the internet, so let me pick up a couple of these. Jim Faber in Boulder asks, in the winter, how far below the dam is open enough to fish?
Yeah, so it's legally to fish year-round on throughout the whole system, but, you know, it'll stay ice-free all the way down through Two Leggins access, so, you know, which is the main fishery. So you can definitely utilize, you know, the whole system. This time of year right now, we're fishing, you know, we're utilizing all the way down to mallards. As it gets colder and colder throughout the season, I'm usually on the upper three quite a bit, the upper 3 miles, just because, you know, that's where the midge hatches are most prolific. Because once it's true, like right now, we're still kind of in that fall shoulder season. Right now, we got great pseudo hatches going on, and the river's still active. Like I said, the water's still in the 50s. Once it gets down to those 40s and even, you know, colder, I'll either stay on the upper three a lot because of the productive midge hatches, or I'll go lower down towards mallards at Two Leggins access because, you know, a lot of people don't realize once you get that far downriver, you can have a 6 to 8 degree variance in water temperature once you get down there. So you can get a lot more active fish, and especially for streamer fishing. So I like to, you know, that lower river, you know, you're typically moving from the boat and fishing streamers and covering a lot of water. If I was going to walkway, there's great walkway and access around 3 mile in the winter time where you can do really, really well. It's amazing how many people are out there fishing once below freezing in heaven. Having great days of fishing. But
when you say mallards, I don't see that on my little map here. Is mallards below the, like, Steve's Run and Hale's Pool?
After the Bighorn is the upper 13 miles of the river, and then Bighorn and Mallards is the first float in what we call the lower river, and that's about a 9-mile float from Bighorn to Mallards. And then Mallards to Two Leggins, which is kind of the last float people typically fish on the Bighorn, is about 11 to 12 miles.
Okay, that's why it's not showing up. I have the upper river here. Okay, good. Let's see here. Dan Trella wrote in, he says, a few years ago there was a nitrogen problem on the Bighorn which affected the brown trout over 16 inches. Has the population of large brown trout recovered today? Or maybe you can elaborate on that for people that aren't aware of that.
Yeah, it's the nitrogen supersaturation, and that typically affects fish mostly where you're going to see it as the upper 3 miles of the river. When it gets put into the Billings Gazette, you know, people think that there's this, like, massive dying off of fish, and, you know, it's actually a normal thing for a tailwater fishery. The Bighorn River Alliance is conducting water quality tests to try to figure out where a lot of that nitrogen's coming from. But, I mean, you're talking about, you know, a watershed that, you know, since all those nutrients are collected, it's got a high pH, high alkalinity, you know, you have all those limestone walls in the canyon of that lake, so, you know, really nutrient-rich water, you're going to see a lot of this stuff. But typically, it happens a lot when the spilling of the water over the dam, it starts collecting a lot of oxygen and nitrogen, and that's where you can start getting those supersaturation of some of those, you know, phosphates and that come into the water, and it really affects those fish. But it's pretty normal. It's not anything that devastates fish populations, and it really only affects the upper three because all of that stuff dissipates as it goes downriver.
All right. Okay. A couple other questions. Phil in Murray, Utah wants to know, is it easy to get shuttles done there?
Yeah, super easy to get shuttles. There's several shuttle services in the town. All the fly chefs in town offer shuttle services every day, and, you know, in the summertime we're running them, you know, right up until dark. So, the shuttles are anywhere from $16 to, you know, $50 way in the lower river, but typically $16 to $25 for a shuttle on the upper river.
Okay, another question, is there anywhere to go camping?
Lots of good camping. So a lot of people don't realize the upper two accesses on the Bighorn, right around Fort Smith, the After Bay access and the 3 mile access, are actually maintained by the National Park Service. So the After Bay Lake, so, you know, there's the Bighorn Lake, which is the 70-mile lake, 300 feet deep, you know, that is the massive storage, you know, for this river, and that's, you know, that's created by Yellowtail Dam. The water comes out of the base of Yellowtail Dam, is why it's so cold, and then it dumps into After Bay Lake. After Bay Lake's 2 miles long, and then the fishing starts at After Bay Dam, where it dumps out of there, which is, you know, within walking distance to Fort Smith. So there's two really good campgrounds maintained by the National Park Service, right on that After Bay Lake. So you're really close to the services, you know, you're camping on the water, and you're, you know, within a mile to your fishing also. So there's that, and there's Cottonwood Camp also down by 3 Mile Access, which actually has bathrooms and has RV hookups. And then going down from there, Bighorn and Mallard's Landing, there's primitive camping provided by the state of Montana. So plenty of okay. RV spots and tent camping and any kind of camping you want.
And as, I don't know if this is the same, Phil, he says, and no adult beverages are sold, right?
Correct. There's no adult beverages. You got to get that Billing, Sheridan, or Hardin on your way up. Like, once you're at our lodge, it's private property, and you're allowed to, you know, bring your favorite libation in, but there's just none sold here.
Yeah, so. Right. What's, you know, I know in the past there wasn't really any good opportunities as far as getting food in town, restaurants and so forth. What's that like now?
Yeah, so, I mean, us, the Bighorn Trout Shop, and, you know, the High End Lodges, we each have a chef on staff that kind of, if you stay with us, we'll feed you in that thing. But as far as, like, Polly's is what everybody's famous for, you know, going to Polly's. I've been told it's reopening for next year. Somebody, I guess, just decided to buy it. So, you know, it's definitely a great gathering place for anglers, and it's a service that's very necessary and something that we highly support having in town. So look for good things over there at Polly's.
Yeah, Polly's coming out next year, it's like a landmark there.
You know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's such a nice
good or
thing
bad, it's a landmark.
Right. Yeah, people need to be fed for sure. So
yeah. Okay. Curious. Okay, let's, if you can kind of give us a tour, maybe doing this first 13 miles, kind of walk us down the river and maybe, or float us, let's use good terms here, float us down the river, and maybe kind of tell people, you know, major points and areas that might be, better for some fishing than others. I know you really like the dry fly fishing, and maybe you can kind of identify areas that might be better, you know, for nymphing or dry fly, that kind of thing. Can you do that? Can you float us down here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this could be a 4-hour conversation. Basically, trout occupy every square inch of the Bighorn.
Sure.
But, yeah, I can give you some of my favorite stuff. And that changes where the fish sit, changes on the water temperature, which is, you know, changes with the season. So in the early winter and the spring, those fish will be sitting kind of deeper in the runs, you know, as insect activity starts to happen, they'll slide up, you know, more into the edges of the riffles to feed. And then in the summertime, the biggest thing I want to stress is the summertime when there's all these people here, those fish slide up into very, very thin water and into very fast water. And a lot of people are still fishing those main, like, guts and deep buckets of runs, and those fish are up on the drop-offs and up in there. But, you know, on the upper three, you know, starting on the upper three, which is the most heavily pressured, you know, section of the river for good reason. It's, you know, has great hatches. It has the most fish per mile and really good access. It's very readable water. A lot of people concentrate around those islands in the upper three. So you got First Island where the famous meat hole is, and you can walk to that from the put-in. That's a very popular access from people to walk from the dam down to the meat hole there. Once you get down below that, you get the Split Island area, which is occupied by, you know, several anglers every day. One Stop Hot Dog, those are all really good nymph holes, I'd say, really, really good areas. The Sandbar down below that in between the Drum and One Stop is a great, I love dry fly fishing there, especially during the Platte Caddis Hatch in the evenings. Then you get the famous kind of Red Cliffs Drum area on the upper three there, and that, I mean, you can do just about anything, and those fish will feed all along the Red Cliffs. And they're some of the most educated fish in the river to the dry fly because they get fished to quite a bit, but they also rise very consistently, and they're very active feeders on top. During the heaviest hatches, the fish will slide into that skinny water across from Red Cliffs on the inside. And a lot of people overlook those fish. They don't see those fish in there. Those are the guys I like to personally play with, are the fish feeding in a couple inches of water tight to the bank, and you can fish a long leader straight down to those fish. The easiest fish that you're going to find when it comes to dry fly fishing, if you really want to get numbers of fish, is anywhere that riffle chop is during black caddis or blueing olives. I don't care what the hatch is, the inside of the aquarium, you can fish straight up to a lot of those fish in the head of those runs. And those fish will get up in the inside corners of all those runs on the upper three. And I guess the biggest thing I want to say as far as streamer fishing goes on the bighorn is you get people, and the same with hopper fishing, that only utilize, they're always casting the banks on the river. And some of the best hopper and streamer fishing on the bighorn occurs in the middle of the river. And if you fish with the people that kind of have the toughest time a lot is they're used to fishing something like the Yellowstone. They just come here and they just keep pounding the banks. And a lot of the times it's better to do the exact opposite. Fish from the bank in a lot of those riffle chops and in the center and that kind of stuff. So
interesting,
yeah.
We did get a since you mentioned it, we did get a question about what's the best patterns for hoppers. So since you just mentioned hoppers, is there a favorite pattern you have?
Yeah, I mean, the Moorish hopper got so popular, over the years everywhere in Montana. We kind of feel like a lot of hoppers get played out and the fish kind of get conditioned to them. And one of the things that I talk about all the time is the conditioned response of trout. You know, they get conditioned to the behaviors that they're seeing of anglers and they kind of adjust. It's not that they're rational thought provoking creatures. It's just an instinctual thing like, okay, I saw that that's bad. Not going to do that again. And the Schroeder's para hopper is another really good hopper for, as far as a natural hopper is. Same with Joe and Dave's hopper. Sometimes those natural hoppers do really well. There's a Solitude hopper that I really like that sits lower in the water. And sometimes that's really good for twitching, to be twitched. Sometimes I like them twitched. Sometimes I like them dead drifted. And then that all definitely changes with the seasons. Pink was definitely the color this year. Like, it seemed like if you weren't fishing pink, bellied hopper, you weren't catching many fish on the hopper this year. That seemed to be definitely the best color. And it seems like the hoppers in size have gotten smaller every year. We had those amazing hopper years in, I think it was 2009. There were literally hoppers, raining in the water. And in the news, it was out there that hopper infestation was occurring. And the fish were just gobbling hoppers. And I got to this one bank with a client. We were out waiting on this perfect grassy bank. It's actually just below Third Island on the upper river. For those of you guys familiar, there's that nice grassy bank before it dumps into the Red Cliffs area there. And, I mean, we put all the major players over this one brown trout. We threw, like, a Schroeder's para hopper in there. It just followed it for about 4 or 5 feet. And I was with a really good angler, so he's getting that perfect drag-free drift. Didn't work. I immediately cut it off. I basically cycled through two or three different hoppers, and this big brown trout just kept following it, and then he'd veer away and just drop back down. And finally, I used to guide in the Missoula area quite a bit, too, and I just found this goofy-looking hopper that I knew wasn't being sold in the fly shops. Rainey's Grand Hopper is another really popular one. And we put that on, threw it over him. First drift, it saw something new, and boom, it ate. And I think that's what I'm talking about. Those fish definitely get conditioned, and it's not they're thinking like, oh, that's a Rainey's Grand or, oh, that's a Moorish, but they know it's bad, and it's kind of an instinct thing. It's the same thing with boats going over them or people walking on them in certain areas, so they know to move and hold during the day in other areas. So,
yeah
that's a few of my favorites.
Yeah, good. Okay, so we're creeping up on the 3-mile takeout there. Or access?
Yep. I mean, the 3-mile access is going to be your major wade fishing access where anglers go to wade. There's a 1.5-mile access trail maintained by the National Park Service that goes upriver. It goes up to all the way up through the landing strip, which is great water. And then all those islands can be fished with nymphs, streamers, dry flies. During trico time this year, I mean, that 3-mile island area was just mobbed with anglers because the hatches, you basically need a snorkel out there this year during the trico hatch, was so good. And it's another great area to just walk into in the evenings during black caddis hatches. But, it's just so popular. There's just so much water there to fish. And the fish like to rise really well. Water's typically a little bit warmer in those channels, which a lot of people don't realize also. So you may not have a hatch going on 1 mile upriver, a few miles downriver, but in those channels, that water is a little warmer, so you can have good fish in there.
Can you actually put in and take out at that?
Yep. Access? So 3 miles a major, put in and take out. So you have afterbait 3-mile, which is a 3-mile float, and then 3-mile the bighorn would be your next float, which is about 10 miles, or you can float all the way after the bighorn, which is 13. So moving down from – the nice thing about 3 to B is it offers the most diversity of angling on the bighorn. It basically, where there's a good variance in water temperature, because you still have the influence from the dam, but the further you move down from the dam, the water starts warming up, you get. Then the other thing people like don't consciously think about is the further you get away from the dam, the more characteristics and the more diversity of river features there are, the further you get away from the dam also. So you have a lot more islands, you know, you just get a lot more water to a lot of the fish and different side channels. So I guess that's the greatest diversity. You can fish that all year and never really, you know, always hit every piece of it. So going down there, I mean, people really tend to stack up in that first big channel, the snag channel. It is a dry fly mecca. Every hatch during the year, if you can get in that snag area, there's fish that, you know, rise in every square inch of that snag channel. It's really good. Same thing as you move out of snag channel, you get down to the duck blind channel as well. And a lot of people need to realize those channels, I think, fish really well, you know, in that 2,000 to 3,000, even 3,000 to 4,000 range. And when they're lower than that, when the river's, you know, at 2,000 CFS, it's not the best to float through them. You want to park at the bottom or top and walk in. A, you don't want to spook, you know, the largest fish in there, and you don't want to float through other people's water either during that time. But, you know, there's definitely a lot of fish, and at times, especially in low water conditions, those side channels fish like spring creeks, and it's a blast in those spring creeks. But moving down from there, you get the SBA area where duck blind channel dumps out below the car bodies there too. You get a series of channels that come together. They all come back together right there at Crow Beach. Below Crow Beach, you move into the corrals, which is another very famous spot where the horses are always congregated there on the Bighorn, and that's a famous dry fly area, really good. There's some bigger boulders in there, which is very, very rare for the Bighorn. And then when you kick out of corrals, you get kind of faster, choppy area that goes down to the Bighorn, or to the Bighorn Club, Denver Club, Colorado Club. It has several names, but it's a landmark because there's just so few houses on the Bighorn because it's part of the Crow Reservation. It's just this big, huge kind of timeshare house right there. And there's really good fishing on both sides of that Colorado Club. And a lot of people will push down and start their day at that Colorado Club, especially if they're trying to hunker down for like a trico hatch or something like that. But coming out of there, you move down. The next major area that people focus on is the pipeline run, which is really good technical angling with the dry fly. It's a pretty good row around spot in there on the river left side as you're coming down for the nymph fishing. A lot of good rainbows in there. And then moving down from there, you kind of got that Gray Cliffs area. There's definitely several 2 foot trout all throughout, you know, that Gray Cliffs area up in $20 hole. And then that kicks out at the bottom. It kind of turns into a big lake there where there's always a bunch of scum feeders, as we call them, you know, just eating a lot of dead bugs that congregate in that, you know, slow water from upriver. Yeah, and then that splits through the Bighorn Rapids and then into Schneider's Channel. And, something interesting to note about those rapids is, you know, I actually hiked up there with a film crew this year above those rapids and actually hiked all the way up on the top of those Gray Cliffs. And I don't know, I've never seen that vantage point ever before, and it's amazing some of the stuff that you can see. And especially above that rapid section, we saw some pretty big fish. It's amazing, some like holding right on the edge of some of that fast water where a lot of people, you know, you can't really wade there, and a lot of people in the boat are just floating through. But there's definitely some huge fish in that rapids section of the Bighorn. A lot of people forego it.
Yeah, you can float that Bighorn as well as Schneider's. You go either way?
Yep. You can float both sides. And Schneider's, a lot of people go over there because there's good technical dry fly fishing in that Schneider's Channel. It's just a really good place. There's a lot of good-sized browns in there. And it's easy wading, you know, throughout that channel. And there's typically some pretty eager fish to rise to the surface in there. And we catch some really nice fish and streamers through there as well. So, yeah, but that's kind of the most popular stuff. A lot of people, that's kind of the two-thirds of that flow. Once you come out of Schneider's Channel, there's Mike Craig's cabin, who was the original owner of the Bighorn Angler, and Craig's shelf right there. And that's kind of, you know, the area of that float where people concentrate the most. A lot of people even push out from Craig's cabin I don't know. It's, there's definitely good fishing. It's just not as good as, you know, the upper, you know, 10 miles of that float. A lot of times people, you know, if they've been nymphing or whatever, they'll streamer fish the rest of the way out, or hopper fish the rest of the way out in the summertime, but definitely doesn't get hit as hard, it seems like, those last 2 miles before bighorn access.
Well, it's a, you know, it's a big float, 13 miles, and if you're getting out and wading, I know. I mean, every time we do it, we basically start sun up and pull out at sundown, it seems like, you know, and you know, there's so much water to fish, and you still got to float it. You still got to get out, you know.
Exactly, especially if you get caught in an awesome black cat is hatching the evening somewhere, and you're up in pipeline, and it's 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, and you got to, but, you know, you're not going to leave fish to find fish. So, it's, I mean, there's just so much water to fish in there. You could, you know, spend 3 miles of river on the Bighorn is, you know, equal to like 10 miles on another river is what I like to tell people if you really pick it apart and fish it methodically. So.
Yeah. And then we're down to Bighorn Takeout, and so that's 13 miles right there. It looks like there's a campground there on your map too, right, at Bighorn?
Yep, there's a campground there. Like I said, it's a primitive campground. The state provides just fire rings, you know, vault toilet, and, you know, picnic tables, but not much more than that. So it's a good place just to, you know, kind of sneak away. But, yeah, you know, the first 13 miles where all the named runs are, and once you get below Bighorn, it's kind of it definitely takes on characteristics of Freestone River, and it's not – every piece of water is not named, and it's definitely a different, different experience.
Yeah. So. Well, you have an excellent map in your book. I mean, folks should, if they're going up there, get your book just for the map, because it's a very detailed, it's the most detailed map I've ever seen of the Bighorn. So,
yeah, it helps on that. Guy named River Rat Maps is the name of the guys that helped me do that, and they have maps for every river in the state of Montana, so the Bill does a great job of making those maps.
Yeah, definitely. Nice.
We sell those at the shop, the actual maps on waterproof paper. So.
Oh, cool. Good to know. Okay, time to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more about the Bighorn. So, Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's flatstime.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Galletta about fly fishing the Bighorn River. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to the Q&A text box on our homepage, type in your question, send it to us, and we'll try to get it answered here on the show tonight. Okay, we did our tour. A question did come in from James in Encinitas, California. What's your favorite section to wade? That's kind of a broad question too, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely if I'm strictly wade fishing, it's definitely the upper 3 miles of the river, either walking down from After Bay on that west side or walking up from 3 mile access. But if I have a boat to kind of taxi me to different areas and to wade, or if you're going to rent a boat, or renting a boat's a greater way to do it on this river just because it's easy. I mean, even for novices, it would be that 3 to B section because you can spread out, really get away from other anglers, and, you know, really, really have a lot of diversity of water to fish. But the lower river, you know, there's really good water to wade, but you're covering a lot more water down there because not every speck of water like the upper river holds good, you know, populations of fish. So
I remember at the Bighorn access there having a great dry fly night there, a huge hatch there, right across from the ramp there. So that's a place that you can get in and wade a little bit too, so with easy access. That's the biggest problem is getting access, right?
Exactly.
Because of the Indian reservation and the laws regarding, you know, access. So you want to explain that real quick to people that haven't been to Montana about what the legal aspect is of access?
Yeah, so we have five major accesses on the Bighorn River. Like I said, the upper two are actually maintained by the National Park Service, the two, one above and one below Fort Smith. And then Bighorn, Mallards, and Two Leggins access are maintained by the state of Montana. And with the Crow Indian Reservation is you're allowed to freely move within the river, within the high water mark of the river, which is amazing because other river, you know, Wyoming's notorious for, you know, you can't drop anchor, you can't walk. It's kind of one of the things that limits people from going to Wyoming, especially do-it-yourself anglers. But the nice thing is there's only five access points, but once you're, there's really good access at those points. So once you're in the river, you can move freely, and it's pretty liberal, you know, in this state. So you don't need, you know, permit from the Crow Tribe to access the river and fish as long as you utilize one of those state or federal access points to get in the river. And, you know, once you're floating, especially if you, like I said, you rent a boat or with a guide, you can stop anywhere you want and walk, wade, and fish. And I don't know a easier river in the entire world to wade than the Bighorn.
Right.
So.
Okay, good. Equipment. We've got two questions here, you know, like what rod, reel, and line do you think is appropriate for the Bighorn? And then Rick Takahashi up in Fort Collins, who's been on our show a couple of times as a guest, he asks, you know, what's your typical setup for fishing, you know, your fishing rigs for a dry stream or a nymph? So maybe you can kind of cover that that equipment area for us.
Sure, yeah, I'll go over equipment here first. Definitely for dry fly fishing, match to hatch dry fly fishing on this river, I prefer an 8.5 foot four weight because you can get amazingly close to these fish, especially when they're, you know, gorging and when you're fishing straight up. I like an 8.5 foot rod because I find it a little more accurate than a 9 foot rod. And we don't have to carry, you know, 20 foot leaders here. I'm mostly fishing 10 to 14 foot leaders on the Bighorn River for my dry fly fishing. So an 8.5 four weight, you know, is my bread and butter. I mean, you're mostly doing it out of the boat when you're match the hatch dry fly fishing. The only other time I'd go up is a 5 or 6 weight is during the hopper fishing. As far as the dry fly fishing goes, for the nymph fishing, I prefer a 9.5 foot 6 weight, mostly because that extra 6 inches gives you an incredible amount of extra leverage as far as manipulating your line and line control when you're mending and feeding slack into your drift, or a 10 foot 4 weight. Something real light line that gives you reach if you really, especially in the summertime when you want to dead drift, you know, some of that faster water riffles. And then my streamer fishing, a 6 weight can work really good, especially in the summertime if you just want to, you know, use like a Rio Versi leader, 7 foot, 5 or 7 inch per second sink rate just to quickly convert a nymph rod to a streamer rod. But for all my streamer fishing on this river, I'm fishing 7 and 8 weights. I'm fishing 200, 250 grain sinking lines, 0 and 1X tippet, and straight up getting after it in the fall, in the winter months. It gives you a great advantage as far as covering the water, and then the speed in which you can cover water, especially from a moving boat, and pick up line and deliver it back into the spots you want to hit. And as far as I'm concerned, streamer fishing is, you know, all about covering the amount of water. And especially in the wintertime, I fish a lot of bigger articulated flies. In my slideshow presentation, you know, I have two pictures, one of a brown trout with another huge white fish in its mouth and another brown trout that's only about 18 inches that has a giant, I wouldn't even call it a mouse, it's some kind of rodent, but it's pretty much a rat that is in the people's, the face of a fish. And people don't realize, everybody thinks you come to a tailwater and you're fishing nothing but, you know, tiny little size 16
inches
to 20,
or something.
20
yeah.
nymphs. Yeah, and I go out and I've caught some really nice fish on mouse patterns in this river and really big streamers. These fish are predators. There's a huge recruitment of juvenile fish in this river, which people don't think about. And there's always those young fish. So, I mean, our brown trout are predators. Truly are. So, anyways, so moving on from that, you know, I'm typically running, our guides and myself will typically start with a 9 foot leader on this river for nymph fishing and put that indicator to your weight is anywhere from 8 to 9 feet from your indicator to your weight. So this river's fairly shallow, but we also don't have, you know, a gnarly bottom with big rocks. So a lot of times we're keeping our leader distance the same and changing our weight depending on where we are. Because you can get a nice long clean drift with that long leader and be able to cover every kind of water with it. If I was going to say, I use those Super Dew assortments of weight, anywhere from size 6s all the way up to size 0. So 0, 2s, 4s, and 6s typically cover you for weight. You know, some guides like to use that tungsten putty. And then after that, I go, you know, 14 to 16 inches from my first fly to my second fly for my nymphing. If it's colder water, I typically tend to put my flies closer together and closer to my split shot because I want to be down in the bottom. In the summertime, when those trout are utilizing the whole water column more, eating emergers suspended in the water column and on the bottom, typically, you know, separate my flies a little farther apart and put a little further away from my split shot. Definitely for my nymphs, but, you know, sink tips for streamers, short, chunky sections of leader and tippet, and, you know, your dry fly tippet, I swear by Trout Hunter fluorocarbon tippet. I utilize it for everything now. It's a copolymer fluorocarbon. It has a softer outer core and then that hard fluorocarbon on the inside, so it has really good knot strength and abrasion resistance, unlike anything I've seen, and I use the half sizes. They come in 4.5X and 5.5X, and I utilize that stuff all the time because I feel like I can get away with 5.5X and not go down to 6X, and I'm a lot more. Like, I can fish a piece of 5.5X all day with blueing olives and feel completely confident in it. So,
would you call it trout? What
was it? Trout Hunter fluorocarbon tippet.
Trout Hunter.
Yep.
Okay. Good.
Yep.
Good tip. Yeah. Good. Okay. What is now you talked about mice, but and juvenile fish, but what are some of the other major natural foods that are available to the fish that we're trying to match with our flies?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people come here and they're kind of in disbelief that there's no sculpins or crayfish in this river, which also, it does a couple things. The biggest rainbows on this river are typically caught with nymphs every year. So anytime you're running a size 16 to 20 nymph, you can catch, you know, a giant rainbow trout, which is kind of nice. But, I mean, the trout make their living on this river feeding on sow bugs, scuds, and annelids. It's why those rainbows get that deep hue down their sides, that really rich color to them. They got that protein available to them year-round. These fish grow faster than just about any other river, any other trout on the planet. They also die sooner because they live a very fast and aggressive life that they're consuming calories all year round. They don't have like this feeding windows throughout the day or throughout the season. So they consume calories really quickly. They grow really fast, but they also pass away a lot sooner than other trout will. Mm-hmm. Typically about 4 years is the lifespan of a typical bighorn trout. So, but then, you know, then you got your mayflies and your caddis, your mayflies, staple mayflies on this river, are your trichos, your blueing olives, PMDs some years. We don't get them every year. And then pseudos, which has been kind of reclassified as a small blueing olive. It's basically a blueing olive with a, you know, lighter, paler body. And then the one hatch that we kind of call a myth around here is the mahogany dun hatch, which can happen anytime in August and September. The past 2 years have been the best and most consistent mahogany dun and well spinner falls that we've ever seen on this river. Before, it would happen 1-2 days a year. Sometimes you saw it, sometimes you didn't. For whatever reason, the past 2 years, those mahoganies came out. When they do, it looks like, you know, a UFO on the water when you're used to looking at size 18 and 20s all day and you get a 10 or 12 mayfly coming down that river. It can definitely be a little different. But and then moving into caddis, our black caddis happen every single year in the summer months, anytime July to September. But we do get tan caddis on some years as well. 2012 was probably the last year where we saw every hatch come off at its typical seasonal emergence time when it was kind of supposed to. We saw every bug that you can really see in the bighorn. I've seen pterinarsis salmon fly nymphs down in the lower river. I've seen March browns down there. So it's, you know, there's a smorgasbord, but definitely, you know, those caddis, mayflies, and then of course the midges, which are best from February through May, you know, are our staples on the bighorn. So,
yeah, Rick. Rick Takahashi asked another question about what are your favorite patterns for that black caddis hatch.
Yep, the CDC caddis is definitely the staple. It's kind of the fly where, you know, if you feed them a good drift and you have it on light enough tippet, 5X, sometimes 6X after they get fished you really hard, you'll catch fish. It's kind of that go-to pattern. But there's a couple of Renee Harrop patterns. The CDC Bubbleback caddis and the CDC caddis emerger is just what he calls it, both distributed by Solitude Fly Company, that are definitely better in the kind of in that surface film for those pickier fish. The one thing that I will say is a lot of people don't realize people walk out of the river in the evenings during that black catasatch, and their waders will be covered in little green eggs. And those are from the egg-laying caddis, and they have a bright green, fluorescent green egg sac on the back, and the trout will key in on that. So definitely have a pattern of, like, they call it a fertile caddis. Definitely have it for that egg-laying stage. From the emergence are definitely, you know, some of my favorite patterns out there. But definitely something generic, prospecting kind of fly, a couple of flies that sit in that surface film, and then something with an egg laying as well.
Al in Marin County asks, can you determine if there will be a spinner fall in early fall by water levels in the spring and summer?
Yeah, I mean, there's always spinner falls always occur. It just depends if an angler's on the water for it. I mean, trico emergences are, you know, obviously your best time to get spinners. You know, it happens like clockwork every day. I think PMDs, if you have a PMD spinner fall on the bighorn, it is absolutely magical. It can happen even in the middle of the day. That's one of my favorite things to fish. It's rare we get to fish them, but when it does, it's incredible. But I think the one thing that's heavily overlooked on the Bighorn River is the spinner fall of the blueing olives in the spring. And a lot of people, you know, oh, the fish were difficult. They're really, you know, really hard. And it's like, well, did you look at the surface of the water well enough? They're often eating spinners. A lot of people, you know, during those cold water months, you know, sometimes it takes longer for the actual insect to emerge off the water and to get out of crawl out of their shucks. A lot of times people are fishing cripples. But we can get really good spinner falls where you won't see kind of the swarming and mating above the water, but the spinners will still be on the water. They may have happened like when you weren't there and still present on the water. So that's one of the biggest times of the year is don't overlook them then. And then I'd say, you know, that just reminds me of one other thing. If there's two flies I'd carry on the bighorn for kind of breaking the hatch. So any time in the summertime would be Harrop's CDC Rusty Spinner, Paraspinner, and a Bloom's Flying Ant. Oftentimes, I always have those as like a lead fly. I'll fish two flies a lot during the summertime and put those on as a lead fly, and they will often take fish even if, you know, during any hatch, during black caddis, during trichos, I don't care what it is. I fish those a lot as lead flies. The spinners are typically always present in the bighorn, especially during the summer months, especially.
Okay. Jeff in South Holland, Illinois, he says, I fished bighorn several times and have used nymphs each time with great success. It's where I learned the Montana high sticking. Great memories. Mm-hmm. So what's he talking about, Montana high sticking?
Yeah, I mean, when you're high stick nymphing, especially in those riffles, it's basically when you're keeping your line above the water. Because every time the more line you have on the surface of the water, the more that line or that surface tension is going to try to drag your line and therefore your leader and therefore your flies. So, and especially on the bighorn where you can get really close to our fish if you're very cautious, kind of stalk like that blue heron, as we like to say. And those fish are in those really shallow water. So if you can get in there and high stick and be really methodical about your approach and, you know, okay, you got a piece of water here, you know there's trout in there, you cycle through your bugs, okay, you found a bug that they're consistently eating, and just kind of work high sticking your way, you know, just not making long drifts, but kind of shorter drifts, keeping your line up off the water, nice, really clean dead drift runs through that likely holding water. It's a very productive way to fish the river.
Okay. Some questions about strategies and tactics, sir. What other approaches do you feel work best for nymphing in the deep runs that you'll find up at the first stretches coming out of After Bay?
Yeah, you know, the only time we're fishing really deep is in the wintertime and the spring as well. And that's the time we'll use those longer leaders most effectively in the guts of those runs. And, you know, the drum hole is a prime example. It's a deeper run. It's typically, you know, 3 to 6 feet deep throughout it. It's a very popular area of the river. But the biggest thing with that is be really patient with your drifts. Like in the wintertime, more efficient, I love to fish like an orange scud and a red midge larva. That indicator, those fish will sit in such slow water because the metabolism is so slow and the water temperature is so cold, that indicator will literally barely be moving on the surface of the water. And if it moves in any, you have any inkling that thing is going to move, set the hook because it's most likely a fish. So, you know, that's really the only time that I'm, you know, truly fishing those really deep runs on the bighorn. Otherwise, I'm, you know, typically trying to focus during a hatch fishing the riffle water.
Okay, so any particular techniques you find work better in the shallow runs then?
In the shallow runs, I mean, the two things that I like to incorporate that a lot of people don't is a dry dropper technique. A lot of people think it's only good for your typical freestone rivers. And a guy from Colorado that fishes dry droppers on a lot of those, you know, famous freestone rivers back there can come up to the bighorn and have really good success fishing a hopper dropper or fishing an ant, you know, with a emerging caddis pupa behind it. Or, you know, I kind of also have what I call the Spring Creek technique. And I like to fish that a lot during the hatches where you put like a little pulse of pinch-on indicator or no indicator at all and really fish like no more than a 3 to 5 foot rig with very light lead up in the shallow water. And we do a lot of sighting and thing this way, especially in the summer months, where you can active those fish will slide up in those runs. You can see them in that clear water and you're targeting fish and you're literally looking for their mouths to open and close on your fly. That's an incredible way to fish this river.
So you do a lot of sight fishing?
A lot of sight fishing, yep. It's really productive in the channels, and it's definitely, if you take your time, you can do it. And that's one of the, like a lot of people come to the bighorn, and they say, oh, I've fished an indicator for years on the bighorn. If you go with a guide, they can teach you these other ways to fish the river and open up like a whole new world to you. The bighorn can be anything to anyone. It's just being able to break out of your comfort zone and be willing to explore and try new things, especially somebody that's fished these techniques for many years. It's just, I mean, it unlocks a whole new world to fishing the bighorn.
And what mistakes do you see fly fishers make most often when nymphing?
Like I said before, walking on the fish. Walking on the fish. People on this river want to go out and fish the heavy, you know, deep, really fast water, and those fish are sitting on the inside. So when they, like, run out into a run, they get out of a boat or walk in from the bank, I always make my first cast standing on land, no matter where I am, because there's always going to be fish in there. So that, and then, you know, also there's what I call the typical A spots that everybody knows on the bighorn that everybody would go to on every other, you know, typical freestone river, the big inside bends. Fish what I call the B and C spots, those fish that aren't being bothered. They're in these tiny little, anytime there's a little bit of disturbance or what we call like diamond chop on the surface of the water, there's fish in there. There's fish in there on the bighorn. If you think there's a fish there or there's any kind of disturbance on the surface, well, that disturbance on the surface is made by something underneath. Well, that disturbance, you know, whatever is creating that disturbance is probably bringing food through and is offering protection for that trout. So there's going to be food there available to those fish and opportunity for the angler. So yeah. Look for new water. Don't fish where everybody else is fishing. And, you know, fish it really methodically. And in some of those spots and seams, you know, make sure you're fishing enough weight and cycle through your flies, you know, switch up your weight and work the water very well in the bighorn because the fish are there. Once you get a good spot, take the time to figure it out. Don't just rush around and, you know, work too quickly, but work methodically.
A couple of questions came in on the Internet. Phil from Murray, Utah has got a lot of questions tonight. Thanks, Phil, for asking all your questions. He says, do you ever use a bounce rig, lead on the bottom?
Yeah, we do. We call that the Teton rig out here. And it's kind of a beaverhead technique, really, but you use bell sinkers. And we have great success on the fly rod fishing this way during high water, but you fish the bell sinker on the bottom, and you fish a worm on a big sow bug or big scud on top. And it's really effective during, you know, it's more fishing. You know, it's not your typical fly fishing, but it's highly effective during high water times. But as far as, you know, doing it with very light lead, yeah, I mean, it can definitely be good. The biggest thing that you want to worry about on that is you don't want to do it when the weeds are really thick. But if you come and we have a nice clean river bottom in the spring and the early summer, that can be very effective and a really good way to get rid of the indicator. If you don't like watching an indicator all day and you like to be in tune, you know, with feeling your drift, that can be a highly successful thing. Just fishing, you know, size 2, size 0 split shot and fishing that way can be really effective.
Are there good things about the weed season? Does it create opportunities that you don't get other times of the year?
Yeah, I mean, aquatic vegetation produces oxygen, right, which is good for a healthy fishery, and it sustains all the aquatic insects in this river. So, it sustains all that protein, makes a healthy fishery, and, you know, those weeds, when I think it kind of forces some of those fish out and up into some of those riffles during that summertime, like I mentioned. And then the other time is when the weeds grow up really heavy, there's typically this 2 to 3 foot strip along the edge of the river that's actually clean. And we were going down, and I tend to streamer fish that a lot later in the year. And it's just amazing. We're hopper fishing or dry dropper fish. So it's kind of an area where you know you're going to be able to get a good, you know, drift, and the fish are kind of concentrated. So there's kind of that kind of clean strip right along the edge there. So I guess that would be the advantage.
Okay. Speaking of streamers, Geraldo in Boise wrote in, and he says, what streamer patterns, colors, and sizes are consistently productive on the bighorn?
Yeah, a couple flies that I tend to fish for most consistency. Yeah, you can say that catching big fish is skill or luck, you know, either way. But the little Kim fly, it's a olive pattern with a lot of flash to it. Sizes 4 and 8 is very, very consistent pattern on this river, especially on bright days. The other is JR's Conehead streamer in olive and white variation, or olive and or tan and white, that are really good. Sculptzilla can be a really good fly. When I move into bigger stuff, articulated patterns, Dan Delecta's streamer is a really good fly. That was originated on the Madison. And then I've had great success with a variety of, you know, articulated Kelly Gallup patterns, especially his Peanut Envy in white is probably one of our favorite summertime flies. But the one thing that a lot of, not again, what people don't focus on or think about is, you know, there are whitefish in this river. There's a lot of those smaller juvenile trout. I fish a lot of clousers on this river, tan and white, or a saltwater clouser that I fish quite a bit also. So the small clousers can be good for catching numbers of fish.
Yeah. Phil out in Utah again asked, he said, you said there's lots of people during certain seasons. This is Tuesday through Thursday. Are there less people? Are the weekends more crowded?
Not really. This is a true destination trout fishery, one of the most popular in the world. So, I mean, there's people utilizing this river all the time. If you want to completely avoid people, come in those shoulder seasons. You can have the water to yourself. I mean, I guess there's, at the same time, you know, while there's crowds here, there's no river that probably handles the pressure better because there's so much, like I said, so much water to actually fish and utilize within each mile of the river. So while it's crowded, you never typically feel crowded, if that makes sense. You get your own water. You can get out anywhere you want, you know, and incorporate it. So I guess I wouldn't worry about the crowds too much unless you're rowing in circles all day sitting in a boat, which I highly not recommend doing if you can avoid it. But, I mean, you'll get – and you don't get a ton of recreational floaters on this river because the water temperatures are usually so cold. Like, somebody doesn't want to go down the Bighorn in an inner tube when it's 46 degrees coming out of the dam, you know.
Right. There's not rapids or anything there, and like you'll find up on the green or something like that. You
know. Exactly.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and there's not many people that live around there to come on the weekend to fish that are local.
80 miles to any population. So 80 miles to anywhere. So.
What about dry fly? Now, what kind of tips can you give dry fly anglers? That's one of your favorite things to do.
Yeah, be patient and observe is the biggest thing. Take the time to set up on fish. Be able to fish the clock. Be able to fish at every single angle. But also take the time. When you get to a run, for me it's not about just catching a bunch of fish on the dry fly. It's about when you get to a pod or a certain stretch of water and you got a bunch of fish rising, pick out the biggest fish. And a lot of times there's an alpha fish up at the top of a pod. And like the biggest fish in that pod is typically – you know, at the top there. So, you know, that's one of my biggest things. And the other thing to me is it's all about being prepared. One of the biggest things that breaks my heart is when I'm in the fly shop and a guy comes in and he says, you know, oh, man, they were just rising everywhere. There's 50, 100 fish rising all around me today, and I just couldn't get them. And I'm like, you know, well, what'd you try? What were you doing? And, he shows me his fly box, and he has no spinners in there, or he has no cripples. And just be prepared. Carry patterns for every catch or every Every cycle of emergence, basically. So every stage of the emergence, you want to carry patterns for. So I'm talking floating nymphs, I'm talking cripples, half-in, half-out emergers, your spinners, duns that are high-floating, duns that are low-floating, you know, something you can fish below the surface film, in the surface film, and above the surface film. And I think that's one of the biggest things, principles, that people need to understand about dry fly fishing, which I talked about in my presentation, is understanding the surface film and fish feed below it, in it, or on top of it, and understanding how those insects interact with that surface film and that tension of layer on the top. It's just a molecule thick, but it actually impedes the progress of a lot of insects on the way up. So you want to have patterns to fish in each style. Like I tell people in when you're fishing midges in the springtime is, you know, the hatch, the fish, how the fish rises is going to determine, you know, reading that rise form is going to determine where that fish is feeding. And a lot of times what you see in the spring is just see the tail of that fish, and they're just eating. And while you see the trout breaking the surface, it doesn't necessarily mean that that fish is feeding on the surface. So what you get in the springtime is those midge pupa are ascending to the surface, and they're really small in size, so they're being impeded by that surface film layer of the river. And all those midge pupa are collecting, you know, right below the surface film. Those fish are just sitting there gorging on them. So if you're fishing your favorite midge pattern on the surface, it's going to get ignored often, like a size 22 parachute Adams. If you drop a little midge pupa below it, 10, 12 inches below, just below that surface film, you're most likely going to hook up really well. So now, same thing goes for fishing cripples in the film.
Sorry, I had to sneeze there. Muted out. I did a big sneeze.
No problem.
You know, and that brings up, like you said a minute ago, where somebody came in and they had hundreds of fish around them. I've had that happen many times on the bighorn. It could be caddis. It could be blue-wing olives. And you look out there, and there literally has got to be 50 or 100 fish in an area that you never knew were even in the river until that hatch came on. So what are your techniques when you have that happen? How do you differentiate yourself, and you know when you're one of a thousand bugs out on the water? Is there anything you do in particular?
Oh, absolutely. Pick out, you know, one to three fish. If the biggest thing that can kill your productivity is trying to flock shoot and just covering the water, because within that pod, you could have fish eating, you know, different insects, different stages of the emergence, you know, kind of a wide variety of things. So selecting, you know, a single fish is definitely, you know, the number one thing you can do when those fish are like that. And the other thing I do all the time is, like I mentioned before, having that paraspinner or a flying ant break the hatch. Show them something different. You know, just because you're not seeing ants in the air doesn't mean those fish haven't been seeing ants over the past, you know, month somewhat routinely. So show them something a little different. That's why we fish a lot of point flies, and we get a little bit more creative with our point fly until we can find something really creative. So, or, you know, what they're really keying in on, you fish something a little bit more creative for your first fly, and sometimes, you know, it helps you get a few fish in the net while you figure out exactly what they're feeding on. But I guess the other thing that I see all the time is go down a few tippet sizes. Or a lot of times, the number one blunder that I see in dry fly fishing, period, is people don't realize the amount of drag on their line. And fish can see that on their tippet, especially, is use longer tippet sections. You don't want to fish a 12-inch tippet section, whether it's 5X, 6X, or whatever it is. Fish a 2 to 3 foot tippet section so you're minimizing the amount of drag on the surface, and you really need to learn how to manipulate your line. You need to know how to do a drop cast, a tuck cast, a reach cast. Those are the most important things to me, and I have a lot of slack in that line. But a lot of people that think, yeah, they might be accurate in covering those fish, the flies are seeing those fish, they're seeing those flies with drag. And a lot of people don't realize until they fish with a guide and have somebody else, an expert, you know, even Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson, they have swing coaches, right? Because those coaches are seeing certain things. So that's the same thing that a good guide can do, is see those small little minute, you know, errors and be your casting stroke or your presentation and easily correct them and can, you know, lead to a lot of success. So those fish are eating. There's something, there's a way to break the code, essentially. And, you know, sometimes it could be, I see a lot is the drag on the surface. People don't realize that it's there.
Yeah. One last question for you, Steve. Do you have a most memorable day on the bighorn that you could share with us?
Oh, man. Probably that
or
first
moment,
time.
Or moment.
Yeah. There's quite a few. I mean, You know, just that first time flowing the Bighorn, it's just, it's incredible. You're just, you feel like you're in Disneyland. It's, you've never come to a place where, you know, there's just so many places to cast your fly. Everything holds water. And the first time you see, you know, a real good heavy insect emergence come off and those fish are feeding, I mean, there's just nothing else like it. And I think the ability that you can get out anywhere in the river and cover those fish, that to me, the first few times, I just remember, you know, walking in, I was nymphing those 3 Mile Islands the one day, and I got a couple really nice browns in that 18 to 20 inch class nymph fishing. But, you know, walking out in the evening, all of a sudden I got to this flat and the whole river was just littered with fish, you know, rising to black caddis.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just incredible. I mean, I've obviously had, you know, quite a few individual fish, you know, a 25-inch fish on the hopper with the client one time, and we didn't realize it was 25 inches until, you know, we got to the boat the first time, but, you know, and some other really nice, productive fish, but, I mean, yeah, just
yeah,
that
I remember,
first time.
That first time I fished the Bighorn, and we were with a guide, and first hookup that I had, I said to the guy, I said, I'm hung up, you know, and we're floating. I said, I'm hung up out there. He looked at the rod and he goes, "You're not hung up. That's a big fish."
Right,
and that's how
right.
the day started. So and it just got better, you know. So anyway,
yeah.
Well, it's time to wrap things up here. We've run out of time, but stick with me here, Steve, because we're going to give away your book here in just a minute and a few other things. So stick with me to the end here, and we'll give away those prizes, and we'll call it a night here, okay?
All right.
Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, "What did you think of our show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away some prizes. And the first prize we're going to give away, and to get these prizes in the future, you need to register in our show's registration database, which is, and you know, you'll find on the front page, the home page of our website. So it's too late to do that now, but make sure you do it for the next show so that you have a chance to win some of these great prizes. First thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, you can go to fedflyfishers.org, a great organization to support. And, you know, they do a lot of conservation efforts and so forth, both saltwater, warm water, and freshwater. So check them out if you don't win tonight, and become a member. So we're going to fire up the database here and see who the winner of that is. That is Dean Wormell. Dean, you might already have won this in the past, but we will put you down. Congratulations, Dean. Dean listens to, I think, all our shows. So congratulations, Dean. And if you're already a member, we'll try to get you an extension on that membership. Next thing we're going to give away is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. Find out more about periodicals and books that Amato carries. Go to AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com. And our winner there is Kurt Scholler. Kurt Scholler in Montana. So, Kurt, congratulations on getting that subscription, one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. All right, cool. So far, so good. Now let's give away Steve Galletta's book, Fly Fishing the Bighorn. And let's see. I'm going to make sure my cue's cleared out. Okay, good. So here's the question. And this can't be any of the put-ins, not the names of the put-ins or takeouts. Name two named sections of the river that Steve may have mentioned tonight. Any two named sections of the river, okay? Okay, now we're waiting as they're typing away here, Steve. We'll see who was taking notes and who wasn't taking notes.
No problem.
I'm going to run this by you, Steve, because the first one I'm not sure of. This the first one he says is B and C spots and diamond chop.
There's bighorn and B to M, bighorn and mallards.
Yeah, and, well, that was you were saying to that referred to takeouts, right? Like three to B, you know, which is 3 mile to B. That so that's and diamond chop is that one of them?
No, that's more referred to kind of areas that fish hold.
Oh, okay. That's right. Okay. So, sorry, Dale, you didn't get that one. Let's see what the next one is. Meat hole and cliffs.
Yeah, those are two areas.
In front of the cliffs? What?
Yeah, there's two different cliffs. There's two different colors, the cliffs.
Yep. Okay, so you got half of it there, Victor. We're still looking for a winner. How about Split Island and Sandbar?
Yep, those are two good holes.
Okay, Larry Edens in Fort Collins, Colorado. You just won the book. So when you're close enough, it's only a 9-hour drive. So you'll make good use of it, Larry. So congratulations on winning Steve's book, Fly Fishing the Bighorn River. And for the rest of you, you can go out to Stackpole. Order it, and I'm sure it's available also on Amazon, right, Steve?
Yep, so, Amazon, or from if I can get signed copies from the shop. And if anybody has any questions, feel free to call me at the shop anytime. So
there you go. Yeah, or better yet, go up there and buy the book and go fishing, right?
There you go.
Yeah, take advantage of it. Okay, so Larry, send me your, you can do it in the same box, send me your shipping address so that we can get that sent out to you. And we'll get that out to you. So thanks for playing, guys. That was fun. And congratulations to all the winners. So all's good there. Steve, thanks so much for being with us tonight and sharing your knowledge and expertise. And we really appreciate it. And hope you had as much fun as I did.
Yeah, no, it was great. I really enjoyed it. So anytime I get to talk about the bighorn, thank you.
Yeah, great, great. Now, are you going to be at the fly fishing show? In Denver this year?
Yep, in Denver and Somerset, New Jersey, and Pleasanton out there, so doing a few
okay,
others.
Okay, good.
So.
Good, good. Well,
absolutely.
I'll look for you in Denver, and then we can meet face-to-face, which would be nice, so I appreciate it.
Very good.
Great. Well, hopefully you've all found the archive out there on our website. If you're new to Ask About Fly Fishing, check it out. We've got, I think, over 220 shows now in the archive. On all kinds of topics, just use the little search engine there, and you can find all kinds of things to learn about. Our next broadcast is going to be on December 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, we're going to interview Chico Fernandez, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing for redfish. Chico will share a lifetime of experiences fly fishing for redfish. He'll cover all the essentials, including rods, reels, rigs, casting techniques, and flies. So join us and learn how to hook up with redfish with Chico Fernandez. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Front Range Anglers, and our other sponsors for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.